Do we have a new treatment for a really bad type of breast cancer?
Studying the evolution of lung cancer.
Can we stave off progression in people with MS?
And is there an adequate treatment for people that have resistant hepatitis C?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on June 2nd, 2017. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, everything we're talking about this week is coming from the New England Journal of Medicine. It's been a bit since we've had a clean sweep like that before, so I'm going to let you choose the study you'd like to start with.
Let's start with the evolution of lung cancer. And you had picked this particular article. You want to lead off?
We have talked a number of times, of course, about the evolution of tumors, of cancers, and how they accrete different mutations along a timeline, and that often renders them really tough to treat. So I'm just interested in that whole progression model and what it means in terms of prognosis for people with cancer.
As you mentioned, there's been some talk about evolution of lung cancer, but there have actually been very few large studies. And this particular study is actually an ongoing study, but these are the preliminary results. They took lung cancer as the model, because that's the leading cause of cancer-related death worldwide. They looked at a particular group called non-small cell lung cancers. And they took tissue from when individuals were first diagnosed, and they did extensive genetic analysis, not just of certain regions, but of the whole tumor. And then subsequently, if the patients presented again with recurrence, they got additional tissue, even leading up to autopsy, by the way. This is the preliminary report from the first 100 patients. First of all, there's a lot of regional variability. When they look at the different genetic analysis, there are what are called clonal abnormalities that drive the tumor. That's probably what starts the tumor having uncontrolled growth. But then after that, there are certain subclones. Some areas may have that, some may not. Furthermore, there's a lot of chromosome instability, and that seems to drive a lot of what is called the heterogeneity, or the difference in the different tumor cells. Although about 25% of the abnormalities were clonal, about 75% were heterogeneous. That predicted long-term survival. It probably predicts how people respond to therapy.
But suggesting that there may be some clinical applicability to some kind of an assessment of chromosomal instability.
The whole reason to do this study is to drive treatment. This gives us some insight into the different genetic makeups of the tumor and how we may need to target therapy.
Yeah, so we may have been making a mistake all this time by looking for very specific defects and addressing those.
Exactly. This heterogeneity, that's the fuel for both the tumor evolution and the drug resistance. So I'm looking forward to what the future studies show.
Since we're talking about cancer then, let's turn to breast cancer. I said, gosh, do we have a treatment for a really bad actor kind of breast cancer?
And when we talk about bad actor type of breast cancer, we're talking about individuals that have been diagnosed. They receive what's called neoadjuvant chemotherapy. Before they have the definitive treatment, which is usually to remove the breast cancer, they first undergo chemotherapy to kind of shrink it. Then the tumor is removed surgically. Based upon that, patients receive additional therapy. But in individuals that have residual tumor, and if they're hormonally negative, that's what's called triple negative, they have about a 50% chance of recurrence. So as you said, the prognosis oftentimes in these patients is not as good as we'd like. So how do you treat these individuals? Well, there is a chemotherapeutic agent called capecitabine. So what they did is they randomized them to routine therapy. And in half the individuals, they also added capecitabine. Over a mean of about 3.5 years of follow-up, there was a significantly better overall survival and what's known as a tumor-free survival. Among those who received capecitabine, disease-free survival was about 61% versus 43% in those that just received routine therapy. And it was even more marked for people that had triple-negative disease.
Do you think that based on this study, then, this is going to become part of the routine treatment for women with this disease?
I think this is a big benefit. At a drug that's already available, I think this will be a game changer.
Let's turn now to another drug that could be helpful for people with MS.
Multiple sclerosis, also known as a demyelinating neurologic disease. As you're aware, there are a number of newer treatments for multiple sclerosis that really cost an awful lot. The unfortunate thing about these and other neurodegenerative diseases is once the inflammatory process starts, the cell death itself actually amplifies. It would be nice to have an effective treatment with a drug that's already available and at low cost. Minocycline, an antibiotic, may be one of those drugs because it's anti-inflammatory and it's also what's known as anti-apoptotic. It prevents cell death. So this particular study took a group of individuals that had a first clinical demyelinating event. They did an MRI to show that, in fact, they had multiple sclerosis. A total of 142 patients at 12 different Canadian multiple sclerosis clinics. Half of them, they gave minocycline, 100 milligrams twice a day, and they followed them to see which of them would go on to develop frank multiple sclerosis. The hypothesis was is that minocycline would delay or prevent the progression of multiple sclerosis. What they discovered was that the risk of conversion was significantly lower in the patients who received minocycline. That was true at 6 months, 12 months, and the gap narrowed at 24 months, so it wasn't clinically significant.
And do they need to stay on this indefinitely, or is this just a course of treatment that then results in this benefit?
Well, these patients continued on it until they had manifestations of progression. So if they didn't, they stayed on it. The nice thing about minocycline is it really doesn't result in antibiotic resistance, and the side effects are fairly minimal.
This points out to me, though, that what manifests as multiple sclerosis could be the result of a number of different processes. We don't know why some specific person's body decides to mount a response against their nerve sheath and demyelinate it. And so it suggests to me that we need to identify the precise defect in people so we can say, hey, you're likely to respond to minocycline and you're not.
I might take a different view. The nice thing about minocycline is it has global anti-inflammatory effects. Much in the way that steroids are used, non-specifically to treat inflammation, perhaps in this condition, minocycline may be a good choice.
We differ. Okay, so finally, let us turn to hepatitis C and the treatment of hepatitis C when it is resistant to treatment.
For those individuals that have taken hepatitis C standard treatment and don't respond, are there alternative therapies? There are over 150 million people worldwide that are thought to have hepatitis C. And our current therapy is effective in 90% of these individuals. That still means there are at least 15 million people worldwide that haven't responded to therapy. So what this particular study did was combined three different drugs, all of which have been shown to be effective either by themselves or in combination with one other drug. These three different medications, they gave them as a fixed dose over a 12-week period in individuals that had already received treatment and it wasn't effective. Altogether, there were over 400 patients that were enrolled in the trials. And what they discovered, the fixed use of these drugs was that they were about 96 to 98% effective in giving a sustained virologic response in individuals that had already been proven to be resistant to standard therapy. That's great news.
It's great news. I would douse a little water on this, cold water, and say, yep, but you know what? Those things are still really, really expensive. And a lot of those 15 million people you're describing are in resource-limited countries and environments.
They are. As more of these drugs become available, they become less expensive. In many countries, the cost of the drugs is less than the cost of treating the disease, especially in patients that have cirrhosis. And interestingly enough, these drugs were effective in individuals that had already had cirrhosis, that is, extensive scarring related to the hepatitis. So you're right, they're expensive. They won't be available to many individuals now. But I think it's nice to know that we do have treatment options in patients that have otherwise been proven resistant to standard therapy.
Right, I agree with that. Do you know how many patients domestically are resistant to just a single course of one of those agents?
I don't think there's any difference geographically. The interesting thing is they looked at the six different genotypes of hep C, and they seem to be effective across all different genotypes. Now, where individuals get into difficulty is if they don't adhere to standard therapy and or they stop it prematurely because they've had side effects. None of these patients in this trial were those types of patients.
Okay. On that note, I would just add this one public health message, which is, of course, we hear that we should all be tested for hep C, that everybody, it ought to be a global test in people our age and older, because there's a lot of occult hep C out there, and there is effective treatment.
A great public health measure, because in the early phases, people are asymptomatic and they don't know they've been affected. And again, now we have effective therapy, either de novo, first time, or even for people that have resistance.
Okay, on that note, I think I'm going to discuss that one on the blog this week. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.